Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every weekday from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing well.
I am as well. Do you want to share with our listeners the recent athletic event we participated in, other than darts that we played on a team together? We haven't really ever been on a team together, have we?
Well, softball. I think we used to play softball way back in the day when you used to pitch with a beer and you put your beer down next to the pitcher's mound.
Yeah, I wasn't really an athlete. But I enjoyed the game.
This was very much that type of activity.
Fortunately, the batter also had a beer, so it was really...
never hit the ball very hard.
Yeah, it was well matched. No, we were invited to participate in an event put on by Ariane Dagan, who has been a guest on our show. She has the company D'Artagnan, which is the
specialty meats, but foie gras distributor. Duck, a lot of work with duck and goose and specialty meats like that.
We buy a lot from them, and we're friendly with Ariane, and so they invited. This is the second annual, I think. Third annual. She started this event in Manhattan called the Duckathlon. And the Duckathlon is where they invite 20 restaurants from the really great restaurants in the city. There was a restaurant from France that was there. There were some restaurants from other parts of the country.
Danielle, Jacques Torres, some of the names that you'd be familiar with.
And
sure.
And of course, we had the Restaurant Guys radio team. So we had the chef join us. We had Chef Anthony join us. We had
Ed from Captain Lombardi.
Ed, the maitre d' of Captain Lombardi.
And we had four-man teams.
And the two of us. And so, you know, we had a four-man team, and I think we did an admirable showing.
Formidable job. We won the steak judging contests.
Anthony won it for us. I said, "Which? What are these four steaks? You have 1 minute." And he said,
"That's a grass-fed. That's a Wagyu. That's what were the other two?
I don't know. It doesn't matter." Anthony got them.
Interesting.
The door on the identify the steaks thing wasn't open long enough for me to know what the question was, and Anthony had won the contest.
But the whole thing was very interesting, and some of the contests were goofy and I don't know, maybe not as interesting as others, but some of them were, you know, identify the steaks that are in front of you. One which was totally fascinating to me. There are six birds hanging in a storefront window in Chelsea Market, and you have to identify what the six birds are.
I mean, birds, feathers on, hanging.
Feathers on, you know. Hanging bird, you know, live, well, not live, I'm sorry, but freshly killed birds. And you have to say, okay, that's a pheasant, that's this specialty bird, that specialty bird, that's a quail, that's a Cornish rock game hen. Yeah, interesting. I thought the whole thing was interesting.
My favorite was you had 2 hours to finish this? So you had about 5 minutes per event. So you'd run around the Chelsea Market down trying to go to all the different places to do the events.
And there were events in craft, and there were, you know, all in that kind of meat packing industry. There were different events in different places.
There was identify different cheeses, which we did, which was fun.
That was fun.
And my favorite was we went and there was the identify which one of these four brandies is not an Armagnac. that was my favorite one. So that was fun. Restaurant people running around having fun. We went out to dinner afterwards and then went to bed because we're old men. tired old men.
Well, I'll tell you, I hadn't really, you know, I have occasionally wandered into Chelsea Market, you know, just to pick something up or after an event, or Frank's Steakhouse is where the event was kind of based. That's where we started. But Chelsea Market, really, what a great little marketplace.
Tremendous.
You know, indoors, right there in the meatpacking district, obviously in Chelsea Marketplace. A lot of different kind of specialty shops and very interesting places. There was that one cupcake place, which I thought was a little over the top. But for the most part, some great stores. That great little Italian marketplace. There was a meat market. There's all sorts of different things in there. Cheese market, great little venue for picking up specialty markets.
Well, to turn our attention to a slightly different topic, I don't know if you, our miscreant FDA has doing some miscreant thing.
That's a hard turn, by the way. You just went from, hey, we had fun in the Chelsea Marketplace and we went up, we're on a duckathlon, to the miscreants in the FDA.
Yeah, well, I was disturbed by the news today. Ready for this? The FDA is now seeking to remove labeling requirements for irradiated foods, which means that your food can be irradiated and you don't have to know about it.
Right. What do you got to know for?
I'm
the presumption,
it.
And I'm sure that what the presumption will be is, of course, it's irradiated. It's food.
Well,
we irradiate all the food.
You know, the idea is when these guys make this argument that, well, the irradiated food is the same as any other food. There's no reason it should have to be labeled irradiated.
Except it's been irradiated.
Well, and that people don't want it. Okay, mm-hmm. If people were like, I don't care whether it's irradiated or not.
Then who cares if you label it?
Then you may as well label it.
Right.
But see, that's the whole thing. People don't want irradiated food. And the guys who are producing irradiated food are saying, well, that's unreasonable. Well, tough tookies. I'm the consumer. If I don't want irradiated food, then I don't want irradiated food.
Right.
And I love there's that, what is that, Center for Consumer Freedom is this industry toady group online that talks about your freedom to not know whether your food is irradiated or not.
Well, the law that I'm waiting for to happen is the ancillary law to this one,
uh-huh.
where what they say is, not only do you not have to put that something's irradiated, it's against the law
to label it
not irradiated.
Well, where Mark's coming from with that is they're Monsanto is currently trying. They're the producers of the hormone that they feed to cows to make them give more milk and come to market faster. It's called RGBH, recombinant bovine mm-hmm. growth hormone. There are some dairies that are labeling their milk or dairy products from cows that mm-hmm. Have never been given recombinant bovine growth hormone. Monsanto's trying to make that illegal.
Sure, it should be illegal.
Right, of course.
Right, I don't add arsenic to the food. You shouldn't be able to.
Careful, you're going
to
get sued.
Yeah.
but we're not saying that RGBH is bad for you. What we're saying is some consumers don't want to have it.
I would be that consumer, by the way.
But whether I am or I'm not,
I am.
But the point is, if the consumer doesn't want to have milk from cows with RGBH in it, Monsanto, you don't get to make it illegal. Okay, you can hide the fact. We're not even saying that you have to put a label on the milk that says it's got RGBH.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm saying that.
Well, I think so, too. But right now, that's not the argument, though. The argument isn't, okay, Monsanto, you have to label it when this Monsanto product is using the cow that makes the milk. We're just saying that, listen, if a guy wants to say, listen, I'm not comfortable with RGBH, and I know some of my consumers aren't, so I'm going to meet that consumer demand, mm-hmm. and I'm going to label my milk as it is, 100% from cows, not treated with RGBH. Why in the world should that be illegal? And Monsanto's answer is, well, because you're misleading the public into thinking there's a problem. Listen, the public has a right to think there's a problem or not think there's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you talk about the nanny state, it's the nanny corporation.
Right. Francis and I have gone over this, and anybody who's heard us talk about milk, it's one of those points that we just keep coming back to because it's so regulated incorrectly.
Yeah.
And I think that's the point we're trying to make is there are certain regulations that should be there because they make things transparent.
Right.
And that's what Francis said. The regulations that Francis and I want to see are the ones that make things transparent, are the ones that make you see what's really happening. And the ones that we want to see go away are the ones that are covering something up, that are hiding something from you, whether it's irradiating food or whether it's putting bovine growth hormone, giving it to your cows that are producing your milk. Anything that's transparent, I don't have a problem with.
Well, and the way that the other side tries to frame the issue is, oh, these health nuts and enviro Nazis are trying to take your choices away from you. No, I may be trying to persuade you not mm-hmm. to have Pop-Tarts, but I'm not I'm not suggesting we take Pop-Tarts off the market. Okay, I'm not trying to fool you into anything. I'm trying to affect your choices. That mm-hmm. doesn't mean I'm trying to take away your choices. But when you say it's illegal to in any way indicate whether or not RGBH is used right. in the cows that produce the milk.
Monsanto's trying to take your choices away.
Because if you can't see it, you can't make
a choice. They're not trying to inflict their opinion on you even. They're trying to remove your opportunity to make a choice.
And we're all about freedom of choice and being transparent. Listen, we're going to go have a glass of milk. We'll be back in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, on stage left. Captain Lombardi Restaurant. It's in downtown New Brunswick. And our guest today is Gail Sokol. We're going to be talking about baking with Gail. She's an award-winning professional baker and baking instructor. Her book is About Professional Baking, The Essentials.
Gail, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
You know, baking, you know, they say that in professional kitchens, and I know that you know this, but maybe our listeners don't, that there's a fundamental difference between the line cook or chef and the pastry cook or pastry chef, that while cooking is, cooking a la carte or cooking sauté or cooking on the hot side is about, you know, feel and making a la minute decisions, that baking is science and chemistry. Is that true?
Yeah, you know, that is true. It is basically true. Cooking, you can put an extra clove of garlic in if you really like that. You can put a little extra salt or pepper. You can basically do whatever you want without really destroying the complete essence of the final product.
But too much baking powder, and you've got an I Love Lucy episode on
you
your hand.
You got that right. You messed up real good.
You know, there's one more fundamental difference there in that the pastry chefs are usually working at 4 o'clock in the morning,
yeah,
and the other chefs are usually
drinking
at 4
exactly.
o'clock.
And sometimes the pastry chefs do put in the baking powder when they shouldn't be putting in because they're too tired. But other than that, it is more of a science. You're absolutely correct. And I think that there are some scientific principles that you have to understand. There's a lot of neutralization reactions going on with chemical leaveners and acidic products and, you know, other ingredients. So you have to understand the role that each ingredient plays.
Well, let's take this back for just a moment,
okay,
realizing that we have a lot of listeners who aren't professional cooks or bakers, but are, you know, everyone who listens to this show is interested in food. Let me just say that I think that people get into cooking a lot more easily than they get into baking because you can sort of wing it with cooking.
Right.
There's
exactly.
No winging it with baking. What are some of the reactions that, if you didn't understand baking, you might not realize can just ruin the whole thing?
Well, first of all, we talk about chemical leaveners, which I brought up before, baking powder, baking soda. And baking soda is basically sodium bicarbonate, bicarbonate of soda, something that you might put in, you know, like an Alka-Seltzer to settle your stomach. It gets rid of, it causes a neutralization reaction with acid that you might have in your stomach, and it forms carbon dioxide gas bubbles. And that's what a baker really loves to have because that's what helps leaven their baked good.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's a yeast bread, no matter where it comes from, whether it comes from yeast or baking soda or baking powder, you really want to build those carbon dioxide gas bubbles up so you can leaven your cake, cookies, or whatever it is. Okay, so the reaction is such that the sodium bicarbonate is a base.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to add acidic ingredients. So let's say you're making baking powder biscuits. You have baking soda, you know there's going to be maybe some buttermilk in there. That's an acidic ingredient. So together they're going to form water, salt, and they're going to form carbon dioxide,
and
which is the neutralization.
And it's that carbon dioxide that causes the air inside your
cake
or pastries or whatever.
I think one of the interesting things that people don't realize exactly the purpose of the ingredients, and frankly, Gail, I think one of the things that's great about your book is your book takes the perspective of why we have certain ingredients. And I think that because baking is so formulaic, the way that most people who are even good bakers tend to do things is to have a recipe that works and to always cook that recipe and never deviate from it at all.
Right.
But by the same token, when they do that, they may not understand why they're putting in all the ingredients that they put in.
There's a lot of professional bakers that do that, and I've had students that do that because I teach on the college level, and I've taught some students that actually have had their own businesses, catering businesses, et cetera, and they will say to me, you know, I've added all these things, it's worked for me, and they get into the classroom and to the lab with me, and they've messed up because they don't understand when you switch things on them what the role that ingredient is playing. You're absolutely correct. And you can, let's say I don't have buttermilk, I can still use yogurt. I can use sour cream in my house if I don't have buttermilk. There are other things that you can use to make an acidic ingredient react with that baking soda. So if you know enough about the ingredients, and that's what my book does, it explains, based on the ingredients, it sort of builds up from there and builds on the principles and foundations of baking and the mixing methods. You can't just throw things together like you said in cooking, you can.
Mm-hmm.
In a pot, in a saute pan, you can sort of, you know, there is ways. There are definitely principles to follow. But if you mess up a little bit, no big deal, okay? But in baking, a little more difference. I see people say, well, you know what, I threw everything in the bowl, mixed it, and nothing came out. And you know, there was a reason because every step, and that's what my book does, it goes step by step with each recipe so that the reader knows exactly what to expect in each specific stage.
You know, as a kid, I used to make chocolate mousse fairly frequently, as much as my mom would let me make it in the kitchen. And I'll tell you that some days I made a mousse, and some days
I made
a pudding.
Yes.
But did you understand why?
I would probably understand why. It had something to do with your egg foam, I bet.
It had something to do with my egg foam,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Let me clarify the question. Gail, I knew that you understood why. I was asking Mark if he understood why. Did you know why when you were a kid?
When I was a kid, yeah. I knew I had done something wrong where the air came out of the eggs.
That's brilliant. You know, in the spirit of...
I was 10. What were you making?
All right. In the spirit of full disclosure, Mark's father did have a French pastry shop when he was younger, so I'm sure he was very disappointed in that. Hey, listen, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and talk more with Gail Sokol about her book about professional baking, The Essentials. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were, you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The maragat and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys, with Gail Sokol, who is a baking expert. Her book is about professional baking. You can find it on our website, RestaurantGuysRadio.com, and even pick it up. It's a great thing to have because it's not just a collection of recipes. It teaches you about baking. And I just want to stress that a great... pastry chef or a great baker is someone who can be creative, who doesn't have to follow slavishly the recipes. But the rules for when you can deviate in baking are much more specific than the rules of what if you're making something in the oven or in a pan that you're cooking or roasting or sauteing. So, for instance, Gail, there are some cake recipes that, or some tart recipes that you can make, and if you say, you know, I'd like to throw strawberries in there. So, you know, so if I have a sauce and I'm making sauce and I want a strawberry taste in there, I can throw some fresh strawberries in there.
Absolutely.
And it will give me strawberry flavor that I want.
Right.
However, if I throw strawberry juice or strawberries into some baked goods, it will ruin the texture and they won't rise or bad things will happen. Why does that happen?
Because they're really formulas. Recipes are formulas. They're really chemical formulas that are meant. There's moistening ingredients. There's drying ingredients. There's ingredients that, you know, will cause that product to rise. And then there's the mixing method that you're putting all together. And they all work as a team to get that final baked good, that final product. So you really can't deviate. But if you want to put strawberry juice in something and you've got water, a water-based ingredient in that recipe, substitute it. That would be awesome. That would be incredible. That would make that wonderful strawberry flavor. So you have to think about what role that ingredient plays and see how you can replace it. And I do that. I also have a healthy baking chapter. I love replacing those, you know, really fatty amounts of bad things for you, whether it's sugar, fat, trans fats, and I like to replace them so I'm making a healthier product. You have to do that. You have to look.
Well, what I would like to talk to you about is, and this book is a tremendous book, and it's tremendous not just because it has a collection of recipes in it, but because it teaches you things that you can take with you to other recipes and allows you to deviate from it, which is what all great cookbooks do.
And that's why my book doesn't have a gazillion recipes in it. My goal was to have a few sample recipes that I think are awesome. There's over 125 recipes in the book.
We're going to take a break for the news. We're going to go listen to the news. And when we come back, Gail's going to tell you what you should have in your home kitchen to be able to do some basic baking and how to sort of enter into this. If you do buy her book or if you don't, what you need to have at home in your pantry. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Cafe Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Today, we're talking with Gail Sokol, an award-winning professional baker and baking instructor, and we're talking about her wonderful book, The Very Instructive About Professional Baking, The Essentials. You can find out about this book on our website, restaurantguysradio.com.
You know, Gail, this book is very different than most of the books that you find on the shelves in your bookstore that talk about baking or cooking or whichever. This book is really written as more of a textbook as opposed to a recipe
collection of
recipes.
You're right.
Why did you decide to do it that way?
I decided to do that because I have, like I said, I teach on a college level. I see students making the same mistakes over and over because they just didn't understand what they were doing, why they were mixing things in the way they were mixing them. So I decided to start from the basics, okay? Let's just really throw everything out the window, all the rules out the window, and say, okay, where do I start? Okay, first of all, you have to really start with the basics, and that is have a good basic amount of tools and utensils in your kitchen. You have to read the recipe and understand what you're reading, and I explain everything as I go. Each step has a photograph to go with it, so you know, are you on the right track, or did you really mess up and you got to start over?
You know, I think that's very important, because in baking, you need to know what each step looks like. And
yes,
in your book, you do have these pictures. They're not just there to be beautiful like a coffee table book, but they're there to say, okay, at this stage, it should look like this.
Correct. Because I'm very visual, and I know a lot of people are. Whether you're a student of baking, whether you're just a housewife and want to make great bread, you really want to know what that author was thinking. What were they, you know, what was in their mind to get that incredible product? And some recipes and some books are not good because they don't give you that, you know, on the way, traveling, the journey to the final end product, and then you may not get there.
Well, and remember what Grandma always said when she was teaching someone a recipe or how to cook. She always said, well, you do that until it looks right.
Yeah.
And without a picture, how do you know that it looks right?
That's right.
Well, let's talk about, Gail, for people who aren't students on the college level, who aren't studying on the college level, but who really want to get into baking. If you don't know much, and one of the things I do like about baking is for most of the things that you bake, you can bake them in the afternoon and then have them that night. And so when I invite people over for dinner, it's very often, you know, the thing's got to come out of the oven and then I got to finish that sauce. And so when I'm thinking about dinner, I try to think about how much can I do in advance if I'm having people over to my house.
Oh, you're talking to the right person.
Baking,
I love doing everything in advance.
Well, and baking is all, like, the finished product. It's finished at 4 in the afternoon. Your guests arrive at 7. Go have a cup of coffee, right?
No, you can do it a week in advance if you want to. It depends on what you're making, okay? I was once in a contest, in a real competition. I made bread, sourdough bread, 2 weeks, 3 weeks before, froze it. If you know how to store something properly, and then I took it out, thawed it out, popped it in the oven, got that beautiful crust back, and it won first place.
Wow.
So don't tell me you have to be up all night. You do not.
Wow.
Okay,
I feel I'm being scolded.
No, you really don't. You know what it is, guys? I think a lot of people make baking out to be more complicated than it really is.
Mm.
Okay, so it gets a bad rap. It really does.
Well, let's talk about, for our listeners, if they're going to go buy your book, and they're on the way home, they're going to stop at the Whole Foods or stop at the supermarket and pick up some stuff to get into your book to do some basic baking. What do we need to have in our pantry, both ingredients-wise and tools-wise, to be able to sort of go down the road of quality baking with Gail Sokol?
Okay, well, let's start out with some tools. And you don't need to have this, but it's a good thing to have, an electric mixer. Great thing to have. Doesn't matter what size it is. Try to get it, you know, at least 6-quart mixer, something that can hold a good amount of batter or dough. And it comes with 3 appliances. Usually it just comes with these appliances with it, and that is the paddle attachment, the dough hook attachment, which sort of looks like a J, like a Captain Hook type of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then it comes with the whip attachment. That's how you get your egg foam for your chocolate mousse that we were talking about before.
The one thing I want to point out about the electric mixers, when you move to the KitchenAid 6-quart mixer,
right,
realize that it's got greater horsepower than those than the other size mixers. So it's going to last you a lot longer and be able to do things that the smaller mixers can't
it's
do.
It's going to outlive you.
Yeah.
It really will. It's a great thing to have.
Not if you use it in a restaurant like we do. We can outlive it, but
we
got to beat it up pretty good.
Story. We're talking about everyday people.
So, okay, and we're going to recommend, and they're not an advertiser on this show, though we should probably call them up after they show and get them on. But a KitchenAid 6-quart mixer is basic. What else do we need?
Get some good bowls. Get some stainless steel bowls. Get some bowls that, like, tempered glass, so if you are putting some hot liquids in there, it's not going to break apart. Don't bake with the pretty little ceramic bowls that may leach bad things into your food, some poisons into your food from the bowl. Get a good set of spatulas, rubber spatulas that are really heat treated. They're actually able to withstand up to maybe 400 degrees Fahrenheit.
Mm.
I used to make omelets and actually melt the spatula in the pan, and now they make them so that they can handle the heat. Get a nice couple of whisks. Get some whisks that you can actually hand, mix your ingredients by hand if you have to. Get a pastry blender. A pastry blender looks like sort of like the oar. It's sort of like a stirrup. If you're riding a horse, you know that little stirrup thing that your foot goes in? Sort of looks like a stirrup. It's like a piece, it's like a handle, either a wooden handle or plastic, and it's got loops. So it comes like a U that are attaching to it. And there are wires, about 5 or 6 wires, and they cut through fat when you're making a pastry crust.
Mm-hmm.
And you really need one of those. Those are awesome.
Okay, so these are some basic tools. What do we need to put in our pantry besides, milk, eggs, butter, and flour?
Okay. Flour is very important. Get some all-purpose flour, and it's really capable of doing almost anything. Wheat flour is the most important ingredient to a baker because it forms what we call gluten. All right? If it has the more protein it has, the more gluten it forms. And that's that network of fibers that forms when wheat flour comes into contact with water. And it makes it gives structure and strength to any baked good that you have. And some baked goods, we want a lot of structure, like yeast breads, chewy pizza, and bagels. And some yeast breads, baked goods, we don't want a lot of structure. We don't want a lot of structure in a pie crust. We want it to fall apart and be tender and flaky.
Now, let's go to pie crust for just a moment. One of the things that we always say about pie crust is, people use vegetable shortening in pie crust now. We're a big fan of using lard in pie crusts. What is the role of lard in baking?
Okay. Lard has been coming back, okay, because of the trans fatty acids thing that's been going on. Nobody wants to use these trans fats. They're really bad because they really do a number on your cholesterol and can cause heart disease. So people are going back to lard, which is something that was touted as being very unsafe years ago. Lard is from a hogs. It's rendered fat from hogs, and it's actually very important in making a flaky pie crust, as is any vegetable shortening if you didn't want to use lard.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a big proponent of butter. I love the way butter tastes, but it has a lower melting point than lard. Lard actually, and any type of fat in your pastry crust, is going to act like a spacer. It's going to help you form flakiness, which is very important in a pie crust. And lard can make one of the flakiest pie crusts you'll ever make in your life.
You know, I have a number of bakers who are some favorite bakers of ours who use a 75-25 blend of butter and lard, and those are my favorite pie crusts.
Yeah, and that's the reason. You love the taste of butter. You may not love the taste of lard or some sort of a vegetable shortening because it really has an aftertaste. It has a higher melting point than human body temperature melting point, so you actually have that sort of that lingering film on your tongue. But I think butter tastes so much better that you want a combination, and you're right. As long as you keep your butter cold, keep your lard cold, you will have a very flaky crust.
So in talking about just exactly what you described about why we use certain lards in the pies. It's one of the things that I'm really enjoying about this work, this book, is that you really give an in-depth reasons to why certain things are happening so people can better understand why they're happening, not just use this and this will happen.
And the reason I'm doing that, I agree with you, I am doing that, and it's a real purposeful thing to do so that people can use my book as a springboard and that they can go anywhere and say, you know what? I know how to make a basic pie crust. I know how to use make a cake and use the creaming blended, the creaming mixing method. I know what that is now, and I can go anywhere, and I can do it. So I'm really trying to empower people.
And if you want to learn how to do it and be a little bit more empowered in the kitchen, because I always feel like a fool in the baking end, especially when it's such a mess when I'm done, you can pick up Gail Sokol's book about professional baking, The Essentials. You can find out how to do that on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back in just a moment, and we'll be talking about a few specific recipes that are a way for you to get started in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1145.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't based on lighting. Lights on Nine is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on Nine supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on Nine has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps, to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on Nine, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightsonnine.com. That's lightsonthenumber9.com.
Hey everybody, welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants. We're talking with Gail Sokol about her book on pastry. Gail, before the last break, we promised people that we would give some examples from your book of some things that they might be able to make at home.
Well, one really, really easy thing to make is a specialty quick bread. It's steam leavened. It's cream puffs. Basically what you would get an eclair from. Super, super easy to make, and there's so many things you can do with it. Only about 5 ingredients, that's about it.
5 ingredients, and I can have cream, and you teach us how to make the, what goes in the cream inside a cream puff?
You can put cream in the cream puffs, but it's actually made from a dough called pâte à choux, which is for a cabbage paste.
Uh-huh.
And there's really no cabbage in it, thank God. But it's actually easy. It's made right on the stove, and you're basically making a roux. You know what a roux is, right? Equal parts fat and flour, and you can make a sauce from that. You can go with one of your mother's sauces and just take off. But we're not going to stop there. We're going to add eggs to it.
Uh-huh.
And what you do is you start adding eggs. So you do water, butter, and salt, and sometimes you put a little sugar in, that's what I do, and you bring it to a solid boil on the stove in a saucepan.
Uh-huh.
Take it off the heat, throw in some flour. I use bread flour because I really want to get a nice structure to it, and bread flour has more protein in it, so it forms more gluten. And I sort of mix it on the stove for about a minute just to get that floury taste out. Take it off the heat, throw it into an electric mixer, and start adding some eggs. The eggs are going to add structure and strength also to this cream puff. So as it rises, it's not going to collapse on you. And then you can form them in any way you want.
So I can make eclairs?
You can make eclairs. Even you can make eclairs.
Yeah. Will someone come over and clean up my kitchen when I'm done?
You have to do that yourself.
And will the pastry be all soggy when I make them?
Absolutely not.
Well,
oh, no.
See, it's amazing when you look in your book, there are some simple recipes like that. Now, and I will be honest with you, there are some pastry techniques that are complex and very, very exacting. But there are also some simple things that really amaze your friends. Let me ask you, how important is it to calibrate your oven at home? And are most home ovens calibrated well enough to cook pastry well, or do you really need to stick a thermometer in there and figure out where your oven is?
It depends on your oven. I mean, if you move into a house and it already has an oven and you're not sure, get it calibrated, call the manufacturer, call a repairman, call somebody to come in and take a look at it. Sometimes it's worth doing, and other times if it's just a few degrees, and I've done this in a professional restaurants when I've worked in restaurants, I will bring a thermometer with me.
Uh-huh.
And stick it in there and make sure that you know that what you're baking is at the temperature it says it is.
Well, let me ask you one final thing, and we're running a little short on time. But one of my favorite things that we do at our restaurant is we make ice creams in-house, and we don't use any stabilizers, and we spin them fresh every day, and I love them. And one of my favorite things to do as a kid was I had one of those Ronco ice cream makers with the salt and the ice.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about ice cream in your book. How should people go about making ice cream for themselves at home?
There's so many easy ways to make ice cream now. There's ice cream makers that you can get. You don't even need the salt and the water and the ice cubes, although it's a lot of fun to do. And I actually have one like that, and I love it. It's basically making a custard. You're making a custard on the stove. You're tempering eggs. You're using milk, cream, whatever you want to use, a combination of them. If you want to get it a little bit lighter, you don't have to use all cream. And then you have to chill it. So whatever base that you use, and that's the custard that you're using, you flavor it and you throw it in the refrigerator and really let it, all the flavors mellow and blend a little bit. And that will actually help it taste better. And then you put it in this ice cream maker and you freeze it. And you freeze it till it almost looks like soft serve ice cream.
Mm-hmm.
And then you pack it airtight into some sort of a plastic container that's not going to develop any flavors and really pack it up to the top and freeze it. So it almost ripens. And I don't usually serve the ice cream that I make for about 24 hours because I really want the flavors to really blend. And another thing to be important to really think about when you're making ice cream, frozen flavors really get really bland. You really want to really punch up the flavor. So taste your base after it's cooked, before it's frozen.
Yeah, it's the same thing in the wine world.
Yep.
A winemaker who wants you not to taste certain things might bring his bottle of Chardonnay in very, very cold because it can mask certain flavors.
Correct.
Well, and the other thing is, they say that, just from my studies in wine, they say that the only thing you perceive more of as it gets colder is bitterness. And so ice creams can be very sweet because when you chill them down to below freezing, they get the structure, they get the bitterness they need to not be sickly sweet. Do you find that's the case?
I think it is. I think that the nose will really gets, it has like, it doesn't really pick up on that really cold, cold flavors. The taste buds are like dulled for certain things. You're right. And I really like to make sure that before I freeze or do anything with my ice cream base, I have to try it. Sometimes I try it two or three times, so that my mouth, if my tongue's getting cold, I'll take a break, take a rest, and then go back and taste it again.
And you want your ice cream base to be more flavorful than your actual final ice cream will be, because it will dull down when you freeze it.
It will dull down, exactly. It will absolutely dull down, because your taste buds, as they are cold, will not pick up the real nuances of what you're making. So you really do have to sort of go over the top a little bit.
And with ice cream, you know, we said with a lot of pastry, you have to be very careful about throwing a little this or throwing in a little that because you throw off the formula. With ice cream, that is your license to be very creative with dessert through whatever season it is, whether it's the holidays or the summertime.
Or as simple as vanilla beans.
Hey, Gail, I'm afraid we have to leave it there, but I want to thank you so much for coming on the show with us. It's been a pleasure to have you.
Thanks, Gail.
Oh, you guys are a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
Gail's book is about professional baking, The Essentials. You can find out more about it on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1155. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to your listening to the Restaurant Guys. Marty Francis of Stage Left and Half in the Morning. You know, we were talking with Gail about a point, and we sort of glossed it over in the last segment. But, and I mentioned I want to flesh it out a little bit. Bitterness is the only thing that your palate perceives more the colder something gets. The general rule of thumb is it's harder and harder to perceive flavors as something gets colder, and it's easier as things get warmer. They get more flavorful as they get warmer. The only thing that's not true of is bitterness. And if you think of it, think of coffee. When you have a hot cup of coffee, it's a bitter beverage, but it's not too bitter for you. But as it gets cold, it's too bitter. It gets more and more bitter as it gets to be room temperature. And if you think of ice cream, the ice cream bay, if you let your ice cream melt and then you try to eat that as soup, it's sickly sweet and way too sweet. But when you freeze your ice cream, the bitterness level comes up and everything falls into balance.
I like it just when it's about to melt. Just before it turns to liquid. That's
guilty,
how I like my ice cream.
Guilty little secret. By the way, the way to get that, if you have a pint of ice cream at home, store-bought ice cream like Ben & Jerry's or Häagen-Dazs, if you've cooked dinner and the oven is still warm, you've turned the oven off through dinner, take that pint out and stick it in that still warm oven that's, you know, turned off and leave it there for just a couple of minutes, and it will get to that point right where it starts to melt.
And, Francis, you and I have discussed this before. Yeah, really all you need to do is put it on the counter for about 5-10 minutes and you're good to go.
Yeah, but I still, you know, I like that hot, that warm,
you know what you like?
Cold.
You know what you like?
What?
Instant gratification.
I am
that,
so that guy.
That gets you where you need to be faster.
You know, speaking of which, we spin our ice creams fresh every day at the Catherine Lombardi and Stage Left, and they're coming off the spinner. Just,
oh, that's the best.
Just as we walk into work at 2 o'clock?
That's the best. Around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you just grab it as it's coming out.
Well,
of
the funny thing is, if you're the owner, you just stick your cup under there and it's, they don't even make you pay.
Sprinkle some chocolate chips right on top and off we go.
They do get a little mad, but, you know, it's my ice cream machine. It's my ice cream. It's my flour. Give me something. But that is, you know, that's responsible for 5 or 10 pounds of me.
Well, not to mention the fact that it's really, I want everyone to know that I'm doing that for you. I'm doing that strictly to maintain quality in the restaurant and make sure that everything is just
as
it should be.
He's the official taster to the king. So
tasting the chocolate ice cream is one of those things that I do for you out there, everyone.
He'll die by 5 o'clock if it's been poisoned. Well, I hope you enjoyed the hour with the restaurant guys. We certainly have. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the restaurant guys. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.